Last week, Late Show host David Letterman received a death threat. It came from an online forum that's said to be popular with radical extremists. The FBI is taking the matter very seriously. Letterman, on the other hand, is doing what Letterman does.
You people are more, to me, honestly, more than an audience tonight. Really.
More than an audience.
You're... You're more like a human shield.
Oh!
That's from David Letterman's opening monologue last night. Letterman also took the opportunity to add Al-Qaeda to the list of people who he says hate him. A very long list that an announcer cheerily rattled off.
Al-Qaeda, Sarah Palin, Donald Trump, Jay Leno, NBC, CBS, The Late Show staff, The Late Show crew, The Late Show studio audience, The Late Show home audience, the National Academy of Television Arts and Sciences, Dave's neighbors, Dave's mailman, Dave's clergyman, Canadians, the Swiss, the Chinese, Tony Danza, children...
And in true Late Show fashion, Letterman also used the threat as grist for his latest top 10 list, the top 10 thoughts that went through his head after hearing about the threat.
Number three, some people get Emmy nominations, some people get death threats. Number two, this seems like Leno's handiwork, and the number one thought that went through my mind after hearing about the threat, oh my God, they canceled the George Lopez show.
David Letterman turning his predicament into a punchline.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
It's Ramadan, the month when Muslims around the world fast from sunup to sundown as a spiritual discipline. Each day, the fast is broken with a celebratory dinner called an iftar. Ramadan falls at a different time each year, and because this year it falls in August, that makes for a long, hot days without food or water. It's a big commitment. We've called a Muslim foodie, Yvonne Maffei, for some tasty ways to manage a summer fast. She writes the food blog MyHalalKitchen.com.
We're spending about 16 hours a day fasting. That means that we're not having anything to eat or drink. So during the times when we are eating, which is after the sun goes down, we have to really hydrate ourselves. So I always suggest people have lots of water-filled foods like squash, watermelons, things like that, because they give you lots of water as you're eating them.
In fact, Maffei has a recipe that could help anyone beat the heat.
I developed a recipe called a honeydew cooler, which is one of my favorites. And basically, it's just a half of a honeydew melon chopped up with a small guava. And those are kind of hard to find in a lot of stores, but if you go to an ethnic or Hispanic store, you'll tend to find them pretty often. So we have chopped honeydew melon, a small guava, a half of a mango, and a fourth a cup of orange juice, and just put it in a blender, process it for about 30 seconds, and you've got this really refreshing drink that is so tasty, fruits that you wouldn't think to really mix together, but it's really delicious and it's very tropical.
Let me pick a couple of recipes that you have for the iftar dinner. You've got a recipe for hanger steak with mango salsa.
Beef is just an excellent source of protein, iron that we need, and we lose a lot of that when fasting. So I like to put a thin steak on the grill. It's not really a very heavy steak, so because hanger steak is usually cut pretty thin, and it cooks really fast. And paired that with a mango salsa, which is just tomatoes and chopped mango, white onions and some lime juice. It's really refreshing, and you can have that with a side of rice or couscous maybe. It gives you some energy rather than a sugar crash later on.
The most traditional way, I understand, to break the fast is with a date. Tell us why.
Well, the reason that there's a tradition in the Muslim world to break the fast with dates is because that's the tradition of the Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him. That can be any kind of date. Interestingly enough, it has just the right amount of sugar in it to bring your body's glucose levels up, because when you're towards the end of your fast, you feel a little bit kind of lightheaded, a little bit off. You know, you really need something in your body. And then as soon as you have those dates, you start to feel a little bit more alive again.
And if you go to our website, you'll find a recipe for dates and cream with chopped pistachios and orange zest. Another key moment during Ramadan is the first meal of the day, what you eat to make it to sunset. Yvonne Maffei has a couple of strategies for the morning meal, the suhoor.
We set about 3 alarms in our house to make sure that we don't miss it, because you have to get up around 3:30 in the morning to have time to prepare a meal, sit down, eat it, and stop eating by around 4:30.
That being sunrise.
So in our house, you know, it's not just cereal and milk. I mean, that will never get us through the day. It's things like eggs or even vegetables, fruits, bananas, even smoothies in the morning. I have my cup of coffee at the very end. I figure if I don't have enough time for it, that can go. But the food, I have to have it. And Ramadan is not meant to be a hardship on us. So we are encouraged to have these meals.
As can be told by this conversation and these recipes you've just described, Ramadan isn't only about not eating. In some respect, I would think it's a time to actually enjoy the taste and the experience of food even more.
I would agree. I think that when you break your fast, you realize how much gratitude we need to have for the miracle of food. I mean, it is an absolute miracle that we have such variety on our plates, that we have any food at all. The fact that, you know, a seed can be planted in the ground and becomes a pepper or a tomato, it's really a beautiful thing. And I think when you go without it all day long, you realize what you've been missing. You start to really savor things. And so some of my best meals are at the iftar time.
Yvonne Maffei writes the blog My Halal Kitchen. Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Now we're going to talk about a giant retailer that's been admired and reviled. It used its scale to bring down prices for consumers, but was blasted as an enemy of independent retailers. And we're not talking about Walmart. We're talking about A&P, originally known as the Great Atlantic and Pacific Tea Company. Mark Levinson writes about what was once a behemoth, America's first major supermarket chain, in a new book called The Great A&P and the Struggle for Small Business in America. The story begins in the mid-1800s, an era before branding or even packaging.
Food retailing back in those days was a really primitive industry. Things like canned goods and packaged goods with brand names didn't really come on the scene until the 1890s. You would go into a grocery store and you'd have barrels of pickles and barrels of vinegar and bags of sugar that would be weighed out for you and bulk products like that.
Two brothers took over a tea business, started selling other items, then reinvented the way Americans buy food.
John and George Hartford developed the idea of what became known as the economy store. You limited the merchandise to high turnover merchandise. You kept limited hours. You didn't give credit. You didn't give delivery. You could run the store at very low cost, and you could pass those low prices on to your customers.
You write about how the A&P's success was also its undoing. Its relentless expansion created enemies, and the government sued A&P. Tell us about that.
It's hard to recall now what a huge business food retailing was in the 1920s and 1930s. There was literally a grocery store on every corner in urban America. There was roughly a grocery store for every 50 families in the United States. So there were hundreds and hundreds of thousands of people whose livings depended upon mom-and-pop grocery stores. A&P really threatened the jobs of all of these people, and there was a backlash. In 1944, the Roosevelt administration filed a criminal antitrust complaint against A&P, and the charge was that it was destroying equality of opportunity, as the judge put it, and for that reason, A&P was found to violate antitrust law.
And in the book, you write that the political battle really did come down to competing visions of society.
What was really at the heart of the battle over A&P and the battle over chain stores that went on from the 20s into the 50s was this idea that we need to preserve small business. Many of the opponents of chain stores were trying to preserve what they saw as the small town traditional lifestyle supported by merchants who'd gone into business on their own and made their own way in the world. The competing vision to that was really the pure economic vision. A&P's methods, A&P's efficiency, significantly reduced food costs for the average American consumer. Back in the 20s, the average working-class household would spend a third or more of its income on food. These days, food is really not such a big deal for most households because the distribution system has become a lot more efficient. But there's clearly a trade-off.
So in a way, it sounds like the battle of the competing visions continues today.
This battle is very much with us. We like the idea in principle of having competition, but the reality is that we have a hard time dealing with competition. Competition means people lose their jobs. Competition means businesses go out of business. It's really very uncomfortable. So while we like this capitalist economy, we don't really want unrestrained competition. The costs are just too high.
Thank you very much.
It's my pleasure.
Mark Levinson's new book is called The Great A&P and the Struggle for Small Business in America.
And today's last word in business is fire sale. Hewlett-Packard said last week it was giving up on its new touchpad tablet after a mere 7 weeks on the store shelves. Seems the device couldn't even start to compete with the iPad or other more popular tablets like Samsung's Galaxy Tab or the Barnes & Noble Nook. But then HP said it was offloading its basic touchpads for a mere $100, down from $500. And that's when the shunned device suddenly became a hot property. Online retailers quickly sold out of them, and now brand new unopened touchpads are showing up on eBay for about $250. That's the business news here on Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm David Greene.
And I'm Renee Montagne.